the first time somebody asked me the question, do you want it done cheap or do you want it done right? I was having a car problem and I took it into this little shop. I happened to be on a trip, so I was pressed for time and money. And the guy, he told me what needed to be done. I looked at him, I said, so how much does that cost? He says, well, you want it done cheap or you want it done right? I think I actually coughed up the money and did it right. But nonetheless, when you're fixing something, that's a frequent choice that you have to make. You want it done cheap, you want it done right. And especially if you're a homeowner, you understand that conundrum. Sometimes something goes wrong in the house and it has to be fixed. What you want to do is get it done quickly and cheaply, if possible. But sometimes that's not. Sometimes you can do it cheap and right, but a lot of times you have to decide which one is more valuable. Now, doing it cheap isn't necessarily bad sometimes. The problem is if it's a serious issue, that issue may compound itself, more damage will be done, and over time a small mess becomes a bigger mess and a much more expensive mess. You want it done cheap or do you want it done right? The same thing applies to our moral standards. You can have cheap moral standards or you can have the right moral standards. And I think that even affects us as Christians. We talk a lot about the importance of our influence to others, but we can be so consumed with our outward appearance that we forget about the inner character that we're trying to develop. Character should reflect, our outward character should reflect what's on the inside, but sometimes we're more concerned with the appearance than we are the substance. You'll not find a more vigorous advocate of church attendance than me, but God is less concerned about our attendance than he is our worship and our honor to him. It's possible to attend church every day of your life and never honor God and never truly worship him. We can get really concerned about numbers, like how many baptisms have we had? What's the attendance on Sunday? What's the budget look like? We can be concerned about all kinds of things. I think the Lord's a whole lot more concerned about our spiritual growth. Are we growing spiritually, not just numerically? We can be concerned about the name that's on the door of the building, and that should be a concern. I think the Lord is a whole lot more concerned about our identity. We can say that we are a church of Christ. Are we really Christ's people? That's the issue. And it's too often very easy to take shortcuts. We sometimes want to reduce our godliness to a list of do's and don'ts, and we satisfy ourselves by saying, well, as long as I don't do this and as long as I do this, then I'm okay. Unfortunately, spirituality and godliness aren't always measured simply by do's and don'ts. Their attitudes and the motives have a lot to do with whether or not we are godly people. Sometimes we are way too concerned about conformity to our peer group. God is more concerned about his approval than the approval of our fellow men. It's real easy to take shortcuts when it comes to our spiritual relationship to God. I want us to continue our study of the Sermon on the Mount by looking at a lengthy section in chapter 5. And it's really dealing with this subject about righteousness. It's dealing with our standards. Do we want to do it cheap or do we want to do it right? Now, as I said, it's a lengthy section. We're going to start in verse 21 and go through the end of the chapter. We're going to summarize a few things along the way. But it's basically this principle of what kind of righteousness are we willing to settle for. As I said, we're continuing our study of the Sermon on the Mount, and I think this idea of renovation is especially appropriate to this section. The Sermon on the Mount is Jesus' attempt to make us over. He's saying that we're not good enough as we are to be in God's kingdom, and what he expects is nothing less than a complete renovation from the inside out, from bottom to top, side to side, front to back, and everywhere else in between. He expects us to be completely made over into the righteousness of the kingdom of God. Those two ideas are the most dominant ideas in the sermon, the kingdom of heaven and the righteousness of the kingdom. So what is this righteousness that he is talking about? As I said, we're going to look at chapter 5, verses 21 through 48. I want us to actually back up to what was read just a few moments ago. After giving the Beatitudes, after giving the similitudes in the first 16 verses of the text, Jesus starts talking about his relationship to the law and his followers' relationship to the law, and this serves as a springboard into this section about righteousness. Jesus makes six claims in these verses. Number one, he says that he did not come to abolish the law of Moses. There were some who would have relaxed the demands of Moses' law, and Jesus didn't come to do that. There were some who, I'm sure, pretty well just ignored the law of Moses. Jesus didn't come to do that. And there are some who probably would have done away with the law of Moses, and Jesus didn't come to do that. I think it's interesting that Jesus kind of brings up this thought about his relationship to the law. It kind of comes out of left field, but if you consider the context of Jesus' ministry, this is the second year of Jesus' public ministry, and already at this point, he has had numerous conflicts with the scribes and Pharisees over his understanding of the law, his practice of the law, the things that he taught, the things that he was teaching his disciples to do. As we've said before, over in Luke chapter 6, I believe that the sermon in the second part of Luke chapter 6, I believe is the same sermon that we have in Matthew 5, 6, and 7. And proceeding on that assumption, if you go back and look at everything prior to Luke chapter 6, Jesus has already had a bunch of conflicts. Back in chapter 4, his hometown, when he went and preached in his hometown at the very beginning of his public ministry, he was rejected by them. They didn't want anything to do with him. Chapter 5, he heals a man who is paralyzed, and already the scribes and Pharisees marvel. They say, well, who is this man who forgives sin? By what right does he forgive sin? In Luke chapter 5, he eats with the tax collectors and the sinners and draws criticism for that. Luke chapter 5, his disciples were not fasting the way John's disciples did. They drew criticism for that. Luke chapter 6, at the beginning, first five verses, he and his disciples eat grain on the Sabbath. They pluck heads of grain as they're walking through the field. They are criticized for that. Verses 6 through 11, he is criticized for healing on the Sabbath. So it is no wonder that in this great sermon, Jesus is addressing his relationship to the law. Jesus, tell us, what do you think about the law? He says, I didn't come to abolish it. In fact, I came, second point, to fulfill it, to bring it to its completion, to show you the embodiment of the law, partly by his obedience, but partly by fulfilling Old Testament prophecy, by showing to them the substance of which the Old Testament was the shadow, by showing them what God intended through the law, he would ultimately come to fulfill it. He also wanted to affirm to them that the law was authoritative. He says in verse 18, I say to you, heaven and earth will not pass away. This will never happen. Heaven and earth will not pass away. Not the smallest stroke or letter of the law shall pass until all is accomplished or fulfilled. King James said jot and tittle. Jot is the Greek word iota. Iota was the smallest letter in the Greek alphabet. It's the equivalent of our I. And it translated the Hebrew word yod. Yod was one of the letters of the Hebrew alphabet. It looks like an apostrophe. It was the smallest letter in the Hebrew alphabet. There are over 66,000 yods in the Old Testament. You should know that. There are over 66,000 yods in the Old Testament. He said not a single yod would disappear. If a yod fell off the page, who would know? Well, actually, Jewish scribes would know. But aside from that, most people would never know. But he said not even a yod. And then the tittle or the stroke. There are several letters in the Hebrew alphabet. You know, in your font collection on your computer, you have serif and sans serif fonts. A serif is a little mark on the edge of a letter. It's the difference between Helvetica and Times New Roman. I don't know if you get that or not, but you might. But anyway, a serif is simply a stroke on the end of a letter. And there are several Hebrew letters. The only difference between one letter and the next is just a very minute stroke. And even an experienced reader of Hebrew can sometimes mistake them. He said not even a stroke would disappear until all was accomplished. But now, there's a premise in that at the end of verse 18. That meant that at some point, all would be accomplished. I came to fulfill the law. And until all is accomplished, the law will not be done away with. But the implication is, at some point, the law would be done away with. The law would end. And then he says, until it ends, it has to be honored. Verse 19, whoever then annuls one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same, as long as this law is in force, you don't treat the law lightly, you don't encourage it in your own life, you don't encourage it in the lives of others. Whoever does this shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven, but whoever keeps and teaches them shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. And then here's the real point. Verse 20 launches us into that last section. This is the point that he wants to get at. He shifts his discussion from law to righteousness. And I think part of the implication is that true righteousness, yes, if you do the law, if you treat the law with respect, it brought a form of righteousness, but even at that, it's still not the righteousness of the kingdom. And so he says, I say to you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. He does two things here. First of all, he addresses why he's bringing this up in the first place. Why this little paragraph about his relationship to the law? That goes back to what we said a moment ago. He had already been in conflict with the scribes and Pharisees over a lot of things for a long time already. So he's really addressing some of their concerns. But he's also, what appears to be a compliment, I think is one of the greatest put-downs ever. Scribes and Pharisees were viewed as the spiritual elite. They were viewed, it's like, if you want to be righteous, go do what the scribes and Pharisees do. And what Jesus says on the surface may sound like a compliment. Well, look, unless you're even more righteous than the scribes and Pharisees, you can't be in the kingdom of heaven. I'm sure some of the scribes and Pharisees in the audience just kind of, yeah. And Jesus' point is not even the scribes and Pharisees with their brand of righteousness are fit for the kingdom of heaven. He's not talking about quantity here. He's talking about quality. He's not saying you had to have more good works than the scribes and Pharisees. He said your righteousness has to be a totally different kind of righteousness if you want to be a citizen of the kingdom of heaven. And then, starting in verse 21 and going through the end of the chapter, he gives us six illustrations of true righteousness. And he reminds us once again that we have a choice. Do we want cheap righteousness or true righteousness? We want it done right, or are we going to take shortcuts on the way that we approach God? Let's look then at this description of kingdom righteousness. Verse 21. You've heard that the ancients were told, you shall not commit murder, and whoever commits murder shall be liable to the court. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court, and whoever says to his brother, you good for nothing, shall be guilty before the Supreme Court, and whoever says, you fool, shall be guilty enough to go into the fiery hell. Therefore, if you are presenting your offering at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your offering there before the altar, and go. First be reconciled to your brother, and then come and present your offering. Make friends quickly with your opponent at law while you're with him on the way, so that your opponent may not hand you over to the judge, and the judge to the officer, and you be thrown into prison. Truly I say to you, you will not come out of there until you have paid up the last cent. Now, each one of these six items that he enumerates on this list all begin in the same way. You have heard this, but I say this. Now, a lot of people look at this part of Jesus' sermon here in Matthew 5 and think that what Jesus is trying to do is show how people have misused the law of Moses. And I don't think that's the case. Whenever Jesus wanted to quote the law, he did it very differently than what he does here. He would say, for example, it is written. He said that back in Matthew 4 when he was tempted. Three times he told Satan, it is written. And he was quoting Scripture. In other places, he would say, have you not read, for example, Matthew 19, when he's talking about marriage and divorce, he takes them back to Genesis. Haven't you read that in the Scriptures? In other places, he says, the Scriptures say this. In other places, he'll just quote the author. He'll say, Isaiah said this. Here, he puts it at the level of hearsay. You have heard it said. Where did they heard it said? From the Pharisees. What he's giving here in verses 21 through 48 is how the Pharisees interpreted righteousness. His beef is not with the law. His beef is with the Pharisees. And he wants to show how they have twisted the concept of righteousness. And then he says, but I say to you, this is what kingdom righteousness is about. In my kingdom, here's the rules. Now, yes, there are some similarities with the Old Testament. After all, it is the same God who gave us both covenants. It is the same God and the same righteousness and the same holiness that pervades both. So we expect some continuity. But this is a contrast between kingdom righteousness, true righteousness, and the cheap, shoddy, false righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees. You have heard it said, he says back in verse 21, that the ancients were told, you shall not commit murder, and whoever commits murder shall be liable to the court. The first part is a direct quotation from the Old Testament. Sounds vaguely familiar? Yeah, the Ten Commandments. You don't murder anyone. The second part, though, is not actually an Old Testament quotation. There are several passages in the Old Testament that talk about courts and penalties, but I think it exposes how the Pharisees thought about this. You shall not commit murder, and whatever you do, stay out of court. Their whole thing was, I don't want to get caught red-handed. I would never murder someone, is what a Pharisee would say. But Jesus turns around and says, well, okay, that's good. Yeah, please don't go murder your neighbor this week. But what righteousness is in my kingdom, you don't hate people. You don't resent people. You don't allow bitterness to build up in others. That was his concern. And so he says, I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court. And then, wow, have you ever done this? Whoever says to his brother, you good for, you worthless. Or he talks about, you fool. Have you ever been driving down a busy street at rush hour and somebody cuts you off? Idiot! We say. Is that really any different than what Jesus was talking about? You moron! And we have all these lovely words that we thought, oh, they're not cuss words. I wasn't cussing. Oh, I didn't ram my car into them. Yeah, but you wanted to. And you see the problem with anger? It's always the other person's fault. He made me angry. He shouldn't have cut me off. My boss shouldn't have done that. My wife shouldn't have done that. The preacher shouldn't have done that. Anger is always the other person's fault. And Jesus said, in my kingdom, it's not enough just to say, well, I didn't kill anybody. He said, the point is, you take ownership for your anger and your resentment and your bitterness. That's what true righteousness is. You got a problem with someone, you go talk to him. Notice what he says. If therefore, verse 23, you are presenting your offering at the altar, and there remember your brother has something against you, you leave your offering there before the altar, drop it right in the middle, and go take care of the problem. You go take care of the problem. But far too often, we let our anger build. We let it fester. It becomes bitterness. It becomes resentment. And we can't stand the sight of the other person. We will avoid them. We won't speak to them. But at least I didn't murder them. And Jesus says, in my kingdom, you do what's right. Cheap righteousness satisfies itself by saying, well, you know, I've never hit anybody. I've never murdered anybody. I've never done this. I've never done that. Real righteousness says, Cloyce, you need to work on your anger. Real righteousness says, I need to forgive. I need to ask forgiveness. I need to deal with this problem that I've got inside of me. That's the difference between cheap righteousness and true righteousness, not anger, but reconciliation. Second illustration in this series, verse 27. He says, you have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. And again, that is a quotation of the law, but he's dealing with how the Pharisees thought about it. You have heard it said, you shall not commit adultery, but I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye makes you stumble, tear it out and throw it from you, for it is better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. If your right hand makes you stumble, cut it off and throw it from you, for it is better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. And I can hear the Pharisees, when they taught about adultery, I can hear them say, thou shalt not commit adultery. Theirs was the emphasis of the action itself. And I'm sure a lot of the Pharisees, well, Jesus, I've never committed adultery. And Jesus said, yeah, but have you ever had unlawful desires? And that's the issue. Where does adultery come from? Remember over in Matthew chapter 15, he said down in verse 18, the things that proceed out of the mouth come from the heart, and those defile the man. For out of the heart come evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, thefts, false witness, slanders. These are the things which defile the man, but to eat with unwashed hands does not defile the man. Where does adultery come from? It comes from the heart. It comes from a heart of lust. Lust is simply desire run amok, desire that you have let go unbridled, desire that you just feed. It's like giving, lust is like giving a thirsty man salt water. It just makes it even worse. It can't satisfy. Lust is when you give in to your desires. Lust is when you see something and instead of just, you know, I saw something I should have, I shouldn't have, and you walk away. Lust takes a second look or a third look or a fourth look. That's what lust is. You know, we hear a lot about pornography today, and it is a problem. Let me tell you something. The problem with pornography is not pornography. The problem with pornography is lust. If we would learn to bridle our passions and rein in our curiosity, and if we would learn to quit feeding our desires, the pornography industry wouldn't exist. Pornography feeds off of this most basic of human desires for sexual gratification. And Jesus said that's the problem. And we can console ourselves. Well, I've never committed adultery on my wife, but have you lusted for someone who wasn't your wife? That's a problem. And Jesus said, you deal with that problem. You deal with that problem. I've read a lot of books through the years about pornography and about lust and things like that and how you deal with that kind of thing. I'm going to tell you the simplest thing I've ever seen, and I think it's the most effective thing I've ever seen. You want to conquer the problem of lust, you got to do three things. Number one, guard your eyes. Lust comes through the portal of your eyes. More often than not, you lust after things that you see. You watch your eyes first. I remember when we lived in Louisville, there was a convenience store halfway between my office and the house. And I had to stop there several times daily for my Big Gulp. And, you know, my 32 frosty ounces of Coke, Polar Pop, as it were. But anyway, I noticed that where they had the soda fountain happened to be right next to where they had the raunchy magazines. You think that was an accident? No. But I also discovered there were two ways to get there. If you went down one aisle, you walk, and the first thing you see is not the Polar Pop. You see the magazines. If you went down a different aisle, it was a little bit further and a little bit more inconvenient. If you went down a different aisle, you could not see the magazines unless you deliberately turned and looked at it. You saw the Polar Pop in all of its glory. And so I'm going to quit walking down this aisle. I'm going to walk down this aisle. You can train yourself not to look at things. You really can. It takes effort. But if you will stop what you look at, a lot of lust will simply evaporate. Don't look at it. Second thing you have to do is guard your thoughts. It's one thing to see something that you shouldn't. It's another thing to let your mind dwell on it. And that's where it becomes a problem. You know, David saw Bathsheba as she was bathing naked next door. He didn't have to look twice, but apparently he did. And he still could have stopped it there. He didn't have to invite her into the palace, but he did. He started thinking about what he saw. And that's a problem. So you guard your eyes, you guard your thoughts, and most of all, you guard your heart. You guard your affections. You guard your allegiance. Who do I belong to? Number one, I belong to the Lord Jesus Christ. Number two, I belong to Aletheia Sutton. And I have to remember those priorities. If you'll do those three things, guard your eyes, guard your thoughts, and guard your heart, your allegiance, you can defeat it. You can. And that's what Jesus is wanting. He's not wanting us to lust and feed our unlawful desires, but to honor others. What if every woman that you saw, you thought of her as a sister or an aunt or a mother or a child? If you thought of them in that way, it'd be a whole lot harder to objectify them and make them into objects of desire. We treat others with honor and not with degradation. Next thing he says, and this kind of follows from some of his... Oh, by the way, when he talks about your right eye stumbling and your right hand stumbling, obviously tearing out your eye is not going to prevent you from lusting with your left eye. He's saying take whatever measures you have to fix the problem. If thy TV offendeth thee, get thee rid of it. If thy internet offendeth thee, unpluggeth thee it. If those magazines cause you a problem, get rid of them. If going to this place or that causes problems, don't go to those places. This ain't hard. Jesus is saying, fix the problem by whatever means are necessary. And then it sort of follows from his comments about adultery. Verse 31, it was said, whoever sends his wife away, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife except for the reason of unchastity makes her commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. Now, again, in verse 31, he is quoting from the Old Testament, but the scribes and Pharisees, go to Matthew 19, the scribes and Pharisees put all the emphasis on the procedure. And I'm going to tell you what, we haven't made much progress in the last 2,000 years. Most discussions that I hear about adultery and divorce have to do with the procedures. And his point is, you've missed the point. And by the way, Jesus is not, again, simply reaffirming the Old Testament. The Old Testament actually allowed for more than one reason for adultery. Jesus had one reason. So his teaching here is not a reiteration of the law of Moses. He goes beyond that. I say to you, there is only one grounds for divorce, and that's his emphasis here. But you know what would be refreshing? I met a man many years ago. He had been married four times. All four wives had left him. What do you think of that? Every time a wife left him, this guy never darkened the door of the church. The only time he ever came to church was after a wife left him, and he just wanted to assure us that he had the right to be remarried. And I'm thinking, after four tries, son, rethink your position. One of his wives chased him around the kitchen table with a knife trying to kill him. Maybe he needs to wake up and smell the coffee and think, you know, maybe marriage isn't one of these things I need to be doing. Apparently he's not good at it. But after his fourth wife left him, we had a Bible study, and he came in, this man who never came to church, and he quoted perfectly Matthew 19, verse 9. I have a right to remarry, but son, you don't have a clue about marriage. Cheap righteousness is more concerned about procedure than it is character. And his problem was, he was a lousy person. Yeah, he was a lousy husband. He was a lousy person. That was his problem. He needed to clean up his life. Do you think we might fix things a whole lot better if instead of worrying about, okay, I got my prenuptial all set up here, and I got the best divorce lawyer in town, and I have the right to get divorced, If instead of worrying about that, what if I spent that much energy and that much effort and that much time being a better husband or being a better wife? Not me, but, you know, someone else. What if we put all of that energy and effort into being godly people? We put all of that energy and effort into trying to build the house according to the Lord's plan and not mine. You think maybe the divorce rate might drop a little bit? It would disappear. And in the next section, he says, verse 33, again, you have heard that the ancients were told, you shall not make false vows, but shall fulfill your vows to the Lord. And again, this is not an exact quotation. It is partially from Leviticus 19, verse 12. The second part of the verse is not really a quotation from the Old Testament. It appears to be more of just kind of a summary statement. There were places that talked about fulfilling your vows to God, but again, this is kind of a patchwork type of quotation. And here again, Jesus distances himself in some ways from the law. The law of Moses, in some cases, required oaths. So he's not bashing the law. What he's addressing is the Pharisee misconceptions and mistreatment. Sometimes the Old Testament required oaths, and then in many cases, it just assumes that oaths were being made, and here's how you do it. It gave regulations about oaths. But what happened was the Pharisees got to a point where they were less concerned about keeping their word than they were finding loopholes. Does that sound like a lawyer to you? And it's hard to read this without jumping ahead a little bit to Matthew chapter 23 when he got on to them about their oaths. Verse 16 of Matthew 23, woe to you blind guides who say, whoever swears by the temple, that is nothing, but whoever swears by the gold of the temple is obligated. You fools and blind men, which is more important, the gold or the temple that sanctifies the gold? And whoever swears by the altar, that is nothing, but whoever swears by the offering on it, he is obligated. You blind men, which is more important, the offering or the altar that sanctifies the offering? His point was, you use these oaths, these God-given oaths, and sometimes God-required oaths, you're using them not to establish truth, but to find loopholes to get out of your obligations. You're using it as a way, not as a way of seeking truth, but as a way of seeking falsehood and lies and deception. And so he said, I say to you, make no oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by earth, for it is the footstool of his feet, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Nor shall you make an oath by your head, because you cannot make one hair white or black, but let your statement be yes, yes, no, no, and anything beyond this, this is of evil. Now, we can spend a lot of time on this. There are places in the New Testament where Paul and some others apparently took oaths. Jesus, at his trial, answered under oath, so this may not be the final solution to the question, but it seems pretty obvious what he was saying here. You give your word, and that's it. People should know that when you speak, they have heard the truth. When I was an elder several years ago, we had to deal with a young married couple, and these people had trouble. They had just a pot full of trouble. And what we learned after just a few sessions with them, we had a lot of sessions with them, what we learned is we could not trust either one of them to tell us the first time what actually happened. We'd have his version, we would have her version, and then we'd start asking them questions, and we'd find out his version is not really what happened, and for that matter, her version really wasn't what happened. And after asking each of them about 50 questions, we finally kind of got closer to what really happened. When you talk to someone, when someone asks you a question, when someone talks to you about something, have they heard the truth from you? The whole truth and nothing but the truth. Can you be taken at your word? If not, all the oaths on all the Bibles in the world will not help you. You got a truth problem. And what Jesus is getting at here is we don't take shortcuts with the truth. And I grew up with people, well, I swear this, well, I swear that. You are calling God as your witness about this? Can you not just say, this is how it is? You know what our goal is? Our goal is to be able to speak exactly what we're thinking. Can you do that? Oh, sometimes. Well, I don't know if it's good for people to hear what I'm thinking all the time. Well, then keep your mouth shut. No shading. No shoving the truth over here to the side. No half-truths. Speak the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth. If you think the truth, you should be able to speak the truth. And that's what real righteousness is all about. And then he talks about, in verse 38, you have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And yes, that is an Old Testament quotation. But something you need to be aware of, if you go, that's actually quoted quite a few times in the Old Testament, particularly if you look at how that's used in Deuteronomy 19. We're not going to take the time to look at it. Deuteronomy 19 spells out how this works. Deuteronomy 19 is talking about when they got into the land, how are they supposed to deal with certain criminal and civil cases? And there's a couple of things that are brought out here. Eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth was the basis of their legal system. It was not considered part of their personal ethic. It was part of the Israelite legal system. Deuteronomy 19 spells out, the judges shall look into this. And eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth was the maximum allowable penalty under the law of Moses if the judges deemed that the case was worthy of that. Sort of like the idea of capital punishment today. Sometimes capital punishment is the appropriate punishment. Sometimes it isn't. But just because a state may have capital punishment ordinances on their books doesn't mean that I can go and kill my neighbor just because I don't like him. And that's how the Pharisees use this. Well, of course I slapped him. Of course I went to his property and took that thing. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And Jesus said, that wasn't the point. Pharisee righteousness is, I'll have what is mine, and I will have my way on this, and you're not going to stop me. I have the right to do this. And Jesus was getting at, no, you need to restrain yourself. Notice what he says. I say to you, gives four illustrations. I say to you, do not resist an evil person. In what way? He says, if someone slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other to him also. I was discussing this in a Bible class one time. I said, someone comes up and shoves you. What are you going to do? I don't know. I said, Jesus said, just turn the other cheek. Well, I don't know. Well, did Jesus mean this or not? Well, okay, they can slap me, but they do it twice. It's on. Oh, well, let us be like Jesus. We're more concerned about defending our rights than we are defending the name of Jesus. If someone slaps you, he says, turn to him the other cheek. If anyone wants to sue you, take your shirt. No, we call 777-7777, the ambulance chasers. I was in this. I want my rights. I want $1 million. Sometimes it is better to be wronged and swallow it than it is to have your way. That's what Jesus says. The courts don't solve everything. And in our culture, we think the courts are what it's about. And then he says, whoever forces you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Whoever asks of you, do not turn away from him who wants to borrow. Instead of revenge, try this, submission. That's a dirty word in our culture. Then finally, he says, you've heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. Now, I would defy you to find that statement in the Old Testament. First half, you shall love your neighbor. That's exactly what it said. Hate your enemy, that was Pharisee interpretation. And I'm sure they probably had in mind, well, you know, the law of Moses said that when something is under the ban, you just destroy everything. My neighbor's under the ban. I'm going to destroy him. I'm sure they probably called up the band and those imprecatory psalms every other day. Oh, this is a special case. This is different. And Jesus' point was, no. You don't hate your... You love your neighbor as yourself. And by the way, we need to notice that the law was very clear. The neighbor that you love, like yourself, sometimes was a foreigner. Sometimes was a non-Israelite. Leviticus chapter 19, verse 18 was where that law occurred. You shall not take vengeance nor bear any grudge against the sons of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. But look down at verse 33. When a stranger, foreigner, non-Israelite, pagan, when a stranger resides with you in your land, you shall do him no wrong. The stranger who resides with you shall be to you as the native among you. Love your neighbor as yourself. And you shall love him as yourself, for you were aliens in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. That's the end of the matter. Not hatred, but love. And that applies to my neighbor who has dandelions. And that applies to my neighbor who plays loud music at night. And that applies to my neighbor who's been married 18 times. And that applies to my neighbor who is an atheist, and that applies to my neighbor who's a liberal, and that applies to my neighbor who's a Democrat or whatever else. It applies to my neighbor who might be a Muslim. Well, they're going to blow me up someday. Well, he's still your neighbor. You love your neighbor as yourself. You love your neighbor as yourself, is what Jesus said. And there is no room for hatred. And I both love and hate how this chapter ends. Verse 48. Therefore, you are to be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. That is righteousness. And it ain't cheap. I am thrilled at the prospect that maybe, possibly, I can have the same fullness of character as my Father in heaven. And I am terrified at that. Because when I look at verse 48 and then look at myself in the mirror, I see a mountain of sin about the size of Mount Everest. I see failure, I see pettiness, I see evil desires, I see one abysmal failure and misstep after another. And yet Jesus said, if you hunger and thirst for this kind of righteousness, you can have it. And so the question is, as always, do I want it bad enough? Do I want the righteousness of the kingdom? Do I want the righteousness that my Father offers to me? Do I want the kind of righteousness that Jesus modeled for me? You want it done cheap or you want it done right? There are no shortcuts to true righteousness. That was the point that Jesus was trying to make. Don't think that you can just type out a list of rules and if I do these rules Monday through Friday, everything's fine. No. Righteousness begins on the inside with how we think. It begins on the inside with our motives, our attitudes, and then it proceeds outward to what we are and how we behave. If you want the righteousness of the kingdom, you got to dig deep, root out all of those sinful attitudes in your heart, and start living the life of a kingdom citizen, and you can have that if you want it. If you're here this morning and you're not a part of God's kingdom, we invite you to be a citizen of His kingdom today. For those of us who are Christians, are we living like kingdom citizens? Are we walking in this kind of righteousness? If not, we need to fix the problem. However we can help you, we invite you to come forward while we stand and sing.